Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme for this hour, the coronavirus. Appropriate and inappropriate responses. Fact from myth. We're going to try in the next 55 minutes to share how you can navigate this crisis on all levels, personal, health, financial, and see the truth of what we're faced with, where our government is on point or inaccurate, the media is honest, we're not following the real stories. Joining me are two individuals, both online. One is Professor Ellen Brown. She's in Los Angeles. Ellen is an economist. She's also an attorney. And she's the founder of the Public Banking Institute, which is a nonprofit economic venture to develop viable, sustainable solutions to America's banking crisis by promoting people-owned state and community banks. She also has written a book, The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity. And her website is ellenbrown.com. She also does a program every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network called It's Our Money. Also joining us is scholar-in-residence Richard Gale. And Richard has been a producer of our series on Conversations with Remarkable Minds and co-authored hundreds of articles on important issues, from environmental issues such as 5G and GMOs and also help with the documentaries, including Seas of Death, to our normal programming. I want to begin by taking a look at just some of the current stories that are populating the world news media. This is from Working Economics blog, Josh Bivens, and he says the coronavirus shock will likely claim 3 million jobs by summer. Policies needed now to curb further losses. Quote, at this point, a coronavirus recession is inevitable, but the policy response can determine how deep it is, how long it lasts, and how rapidly the economy bounces back. That's one. Separately, this is from The Guardian in Great Britain. We're scared. U.S. service workers see livelihoods vanish among the coronavirus. The global pandemic is dealing a devastating blow to workers who rely on tips and service fees to pay their bills. And, quote, as a banquet server at 2 ritzy Los Angeles hotels, she knows her business is feast or famine, depending upon the time of year. In summers, when conventions and conferences dry up, Stanford and her colleagues don't work very much at all, but they bring in huge hauls during awards and conference seasons, and it's then that they budget and save. Well, that's all going to change now. So what are we going to do about all the individuals who are going to be out of work and are out of work now? A separate story, and this is from the, in fact, I'm going to ask Richard Gale to deal with this in a little bit, coronavirus news. Death toll in Italy rises by 16% in 24 hours. Why? If they're in self-isolation or whole communities are quarantined and you're only allowed to go out to get medical treatment or to buy, and they are limiting people in supermarkets to 5 at a time, or in small stores, 1 person at a time. As a result, there are long queues or long lines. He will deal with that. Also, from the New York Times today, a headline, this is how the coronavirus will destroy the economy. This once-in-a-century pandemic is hitting a world economy saddled with record levels of debt. Quote, though the Federal Reserve moved over the weekend to slash rates and buy treasuries, markets around the world fell on Monday anyway. The coronavirus threatens to set off financial contagion in a world economy with very different vulnerabilities than on the eve of the global financial crisis 12 years ago. In key ways, the world is now as or more deeply in debt as it has been the last big crisis hit. But the largest and most risky pools of debt have shifted from households and banks in the United States, which were restrained by regulations after the crisis, to corporations all over the world. We're going to ask Ellen Brown to address this and in detail, and Richard and I finished what may be the only report of its kind where we simply asked a basic question and used only official sources as facts. How much debt do we have? I'm talking about debt such as credit cards and student loans and car payments, mortgage payments, payments for other bills. How many people are living paycheck to paycheck? How many Americans only can come up with $500 at most if they needed it? Everything else is paid with a credit card. Now, that credit card payment is incorporated into our gross domestic product as if that were a good thing. It's not a good thing when debt becomes an asset in the alchemy of Wall Street. Instead of looking at it what it is, people have no money. Most people are struggling and cannot afford to be out of work and hence are frequently going to work sick and therefore risking spreading that to other people. So that is a problem. Are we addressing underfunded entitlements? Unfunded entitlements? What is our state debt, our local city debt? Has any city and state in America balanced their budget by constitutional requirements they're supposed to, like New York and California? Neither have balanced their budgets in a long time. And yet when you add all this together, Richard Gale and I added it, and it's over $270 trillion. Now, if you're comparing all other economies without a coronavirus epidemic, and you say Greece at 180% debt to the gross domestic product, and Italy at around the same, France nearly the same, and we're considering them financially responsible, and yet our gross domestic product is around $22 trillion, more or less, and our debt is $200-plus trillion, that means we're the most indebted nation in the developed world, yet not a single word of criticism. What is it going to mean to the unemployment toll? When we say we have a 3.3% unemployment, which is a complete lie because it did not include 102 million Americans who once worked full-time and earned livings who now are not included in the unemployment numbers. How did they come up with that magical number, which is more realistically between 22 and 26% official or unofficial unemployment? But they don't talk about that. The pundits don't discuss it. Why not? Ellen Brown will. Because we're going to ask, how will the coronavirus, how will the fear of traveling, how will the hotels closing down that at this time of year would be getting business, how will all this impact our economy in the short term and long term? We're also going to be talking with Richard about the study from New Atlas from Rich Hardy that says the COVID-19, that's the coronavirus, spread in China fueled by stealth transmission. Quote, a new study published in the journal Science has tracked the spread of the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, across China in January, concluding 86% of early infections were undocumented. The researchers suggest a, quote, radical increase, end quote, in identification of undocumented cases is vital to slow the spread. The study from scientists at Columbia University, Imperial College London, University of California, Davis, and the University of Hong Kong used a computer model to simulate the spread of the virus based upon reported cases in 375 Chinese cities in a 13-day period. So what does that mean? Is anyone considering how many people traveled in the 5,500 flights per day around the United States who may be infected with no symptoms and then infected other people on the plane? And what are those people going home with no symptoms but infecting people if they were school teachers, other teachers and students, athletes, and other athletes in their competition, and then people in the galleries, people, the spectators, in hockey games, soccer games, basketball games? How many of those have been infected who were asymptomatic when they were in those environments? The other day at three major stores, I saw no one protecting themselves, not with gloves, not with masks, not with ionizers, nothing. How many of those people then were exposed to someone who was infected but asymptomatic? And then how are we supposed to track them? What are the solutions? Richard Gale will weigh in on that. So that's our program for today. Let us go start with Richard Gale. Richard, three things I'd like to get out. One, in other countries, they are considering how to build up the immune system with botanicals and natural nutrients that are inexpensive and easily to attain, especially in China, since they are the world's leading maker of many of these, of helping their citizens, and not a word of this in the American media or the scientific community or in the CDC, the FDA, the White House. Nobody's talking about how to help your immune system prevent becoming infected if you're exposed, or if you are exposed, how helping yourself, since they have no actual medicines proven with proper studies to benefit a person who has been infected. The form is yours.
So China has now has been mobilizing to begin using vitamin C extensively through the hospitals for treating. This is treating the existing infections, and they've been having remarkable success with this. There was a the city government of Shanghai, which is the first or second largest city in China, is now actively using intravenous vitamin C. There was a trial. You can find the actual clinical details of this trial being conducted at Shangnan Hospital of Wuhan, where they're using 24,000 milligrams per day intravenously of vitamin C. And as I said, that can be found in the U.S. National Library of Medicine, that study. So this is one avenue they're doing. It's not to say it's the only thing they're doing. Yes, they are doing drug therapy as well, but they are also have a much more of an integrative approach. There has been evidence, and now these are population studies, so you have to kind of take them with a bit of a grain of salt, population studies, because they're not biological. But when they've been looking at different provinces in China, in some of the provinces where the population is more inclined to take traditional Chinese medicine than many of the traditional herbal formulas, there is a much greater reduction in the rates of coronavirus infection in those provinces compared to those where the use of traditional Chinese medicine is lower. That's another interesting study. As I said about, we've spoken a little bit before, we speak a lot about vitamin C, actually. So the one very important thing with vitamin C is its antioxidant properties. And what happens in upper respiratory lung infections, and worse, lower respiratory lung infections, when the coronavirus gets deeper into the lung, is there's a great deal of mitochondrial damage, and due to oxidative stress and the stress on their lung cells. So vitamin C is very important for reducing oxidative stress and to protect the mitochondrial membrane, and it also provides different kinds of immune defenses to the stem cells as well, because there are lung stem cells. It also will help to relieve the possibility of cytokine storms, as I stated before. And it seems that it's the cytokine storms in the body. So cytokines are the anti-inflammatory bioagents in your body. Your body produces, but when they tip or go over a particular threshold, it creates what's called a cytokine storm. So it's almost like an autoimmune system. The body is now kicking in as an enemy against itself. So vitamin C, and of course we could recommend green tea extract, because it has EGCG, which is a very important cytokine suppressor. It's probably one of the best natural cytokine suppressors that I know of. I would also say that there's we'd like to speak about the nitric oxide as well. This is something very new. There has been research done, and this goes back with the SARS outbreak in 2004, as well as the MERS outbreak, and they were investigating and looking at the use of nitric oxide in patients infected with the coronavirus, to reverse pulmonary hypertension, and to reduce it would also as well to reduce the need for artificial ventilation and ventilation machines. And so there were studies that were done in Sweden, which were quite amazing, where they found that the nitric oxide reduced the SARS coronavirus replication rate. And then just earlier this month, Shijing Hospital in China, along with Massachusetts General Hospital, just started a clinical trial. It's a randomized clinical trial. To use nitric oxide to prevent the progression of the COVID-19 virus. So I know Gary could speak a little bit more on how to boost and increase your nitric oxide in your body. Eat plenty of beets for certain, certainly one of them. But if you are deficient in vitamin C, it will reduce your body's production of nitric oxide. So again, this is another very important reason for supplementing yourself with sufficient amounts of vitamin C. Would you like me to go into
compounds? Yes, I do. And let me just answer the first question. Two things that everyone can do to increase their nitric oxide is you can drink beet juice or eat beets. You can eat pomegranates. If they're not in season, and right now they're not, you can buy them organic frozen, and you can buy a large package, 3-pound package. It's not expensive. And that way you can have yourself what would be a cup, full cup. That's a serving each day. Or you can go to one of the commercial brands of pomegranate concentrate, where you're going to get far more nitric oxide because they're taking, let's say, a pound of pomegranates and they're the seeds, and they're crushing them, and as the juice comes out, they wick off the water about anywhere from a third to about 30 to 40%, and so you're given a lot more. That's what I would recommend. Now, those two things alone, just those two things, will increase your nitric oxide and therefore help you, and the studies show that this is very beneficial. Forget all the other good things that, like resveratrol and other things you can get. I'm just talking about nitric oxide. Now, Richard, one thing that no one is addressing, and at the end of your current discussion, I'd like for you to address it, is that we have a little over 900,000 hospital beds in America. Currently, most of those, with the exception of about 300,000, are taken by the normal critical care or chronic care patients. And when you're looking at the latest figures of how serious could this become, how many people could become infected in the United States, and how many people would need hospital care and critical care, the number is staggering. I mean, in fact, there's an article in a current research paper I just saw today, University of Texas. It says it's not just people with symptoms who can spread the coronavirus. Quote, the time between cases in a chain of transmission of the COVID-19, which is the virus, is less than a week, new research shows. Quote, more than 10% of patients become infected from somebody who has the virus but does not yet have symptoms, the study has shown. And this was published in the current Emergency Infectious Disease Journal. Now, mind you, imagine when I went to yesterday to get a semi-annual skin checkup, just examining my skin to make sure on my back and neck and head there's no precancerous lesions. I think any responsible person over the age of 40 who's been in the sun a lot should do that. And not a single person in the doctor's office, no physician, of which there were 7, no nurses, of which I believe there are 12 or 14, none of the other receptionists, no one in that office had any protection or gloves, were shaking hands, yes. No surfaces were cleaned. The pen that you sign in with had been used by everyone for who knows how long. And when I brought this to the attention of the physician, and he knows my scientific background in public health with a PhD in human nutrition and public health science and a research fellow at the Institute, and I said, at the very least, all of these people who are coming in face-to-face contact up close to do these simple procedures No one's wearing masks. No one's protected. You put yourself at risk. And he's, well, we haven't seen anyone who's sick. And this is what this article is saying. But, quote, the time between cases and a chain of transmission of the coronavirus is less than a week. So healthy today, and then, but still infected. No symptoms, no temperature. That's why all those people being measured by their body temperature in China, I believe, those are the people who did not yet manifest the symptoms but was seeding the virus and then went home, went to school. Think of the transmission. Think of the transmissibility. I believe we could have tens of millions of Americans in the next month or two, based upon their interactions with the people who are asymptomatic but infected, end up coming down with this. So where exactly are we supposed to put people who need respirators? Because now I'm told that by one person who works in a major New York hospital, that they're no longer doing transplants for heart, liver, and kidney patients because all those ventilators are going towards people with the coronavirus. And let's say one of the figures I saw that you sent me, Richard, was they expect anywhere from 161 million to 220 million Americans to be infected. That's either half the American population or two-thirds of the American population, with 1.2 million deaths. Now, let's just say that's grossly exaggerated. Let's say that, like China and Singapore, we get ahead of it by quarantining people and testing people with accurate tests that we don't have now. You're still looking at millions of people. When we only have 300,000 beds available, where exactly are we supposed to put all of these infected people? We're completely unprepared for all this. Your thoughts, please. And please continue going on with some of the other ideas of how to build up the body's immune system to help protect you, and if you are infected, as part of your armamentarium for helping to get well.
Well, I think our health officials are going to have quite a task on their hands because they're going to have to become very creative and innovative. You just can't produce these the ventilator machines and of that of the quality necessary in hospitals just overnight. So there will have to be, I don't know what to really say, Gary, in terms of what a solution would be. There would have to be something around to people being receiving some kind of care at home as well. Of course, the big danger of being in a hospital is that there are so many other infectious diseases that are spread around in hospitals. There's some infectious diseases like Pseudomonas, which are almost only get in hospital settings. Pneumonia is much more rife. So there is something to be said about whatever we could try to do in terms of home care as well. That would seem to me to be one solution. Because clearly we're not prepared for this, and there's many, many independent medical voices in the professional medical community have been stating that we're just completely unprepared. This is just showing all the cracks in our healthcare system today, and everything we've been trying. Our health officials from the past 3-4 administrations have just been covering up, and it's just all coming home to roost in that respect. Just to go back, I guess one thing that's very important, we stated this during the webinar, one of the worst things you can really do is to get, at least based on what the science looks like, is to get a flu shot, to get an influenza shot. And the CDC is recommending this. Doctors are going to be recommending. It's the idea that you're just protecting yourself from one possible co-infection. However, we're discovering is there's what's called viral interference, meaning that means that when you receive a vaccine and there's a virus there, although perhaps it will provide the immunity you need to protect you from that virus, it weakens other parts of your immune system, whereby you become much more susceptible for infection from other viruses. And the two studies that really came out regarding that was one was done at by the Armed Forces Health Surveillance Branch at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And the researchers there discovered that they were doing it with the military personnel who are required to get flu shot. But what they discovered were those who were receiving the flu shot, that they were made them more susceptible to other non-influenza respiratory viral infections. And in that group of infections that the soldiers were more susceptible to, one was the coronavirus. One that they identified was the coronavirus. But I think the other more important study was the one that came out of the University of Hong Kong some years back in 2012 or so. And that, because that was a double-blind, randomized, controlled study where they followed two groups of participants, one that received the flu vaccine and then another group that just received a real placebo, just a saline or sugar placebo, and they followed them for nine months. And what they discovered, there was no really statistical difference in the influenza infections between the vaccinated group and the placebo group. But more important was that there was almost 100% increase in other respiratory infections that the recipients of the flu vaccine received. So that's just something to be aware of, that somehow through viral interference with the vaccine, that it's making us, it's weakening other parts of our immune system or making us more susceptible to the coronavirus. And that Hong Kong study also, they found that the coronavirus was one of those that the recipients of the flu vaccine came down with. Just looking at some of the other botanicals that people can do, I've been taking astragalus daily. There's a lot of research that's been done on astragalus. Jinlin Academy of Agricultural Sciences in China conducted a big study. It was published in Microbiological Pathways. And that study concluded that it exhibited antiviral properties that could treat infectious bronchitis caused by avian coronavirus. They're different. There's the other kind of animal coronaviruses, but that's all they were looking at for that particular study. And then just 2 weeks ago, or now it's about three weeks ago, the Beijing University of Chinese Medicine did a large analysis looking at all the previous research and the benefits of different Chinese herbal formulas against the SARS coronavirus. And this COVID-19 we have is sometimes being called SARS-2. So these two coronavirus strains are very, very, very related. And in the different studies that they looked at, those that had been receiving traditional Chinese medical formulas with the astragalus, there was no contraction of the illness, and nor would, and as well as for H1N1 swine flu influenza as well, and some other studies. So those are two very important studies, I think, that kind of showed the benefits of astragalus. I've been one of the discoveries I had that I felt was quite a surprise to me was licorice root. And I was quite amazed at the amount of research that's been done with licorice root, and in particular one compound of licorice called glycyrrhizin acid. There's several molecules of glycyrrhizin that's found in licorice, and there's been quite a few studies done with this specifically for the SARS coronavirus and the MERS coronavirus. In fact, Japan's National Institute of Infectious Diseases reported the licorice's effectiveness against coronavirus and for severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. There was a study that was done out of Frankfurt University Medical School treating patients with SARS, and the researchers' conclusion of that study was that their findings suggest that glycyrrhizin should be assessed for treatment of SARS coronavirus infections. There are other studies that were done.
Richard, we're going to be bringing Ellen in here in a moment, and we're going to, at the end of the program, I'd like you to go through the other ones like zinc and elderberry concentrate and echinacea. that you have found from the scientific peer review literature that's also beneficial. But before we go to Ellen, I just want to allay people's fears that as long as you're keeping yourself as isolated as reasonable, and that's one of the things that people are finding in other countries that are succeeding, where the incidence of infection is dropping and death is dropping. Here we're expanding, like in Italy, because the Italians, before they did the quarantine, a lot of people were infected, and we're seeing secondary infections because of that. Like when you go out to an opera, you go to a soccer match, you go to a restaurant, and in a lot of places in Italy, they love to gather for a late dinner, generally longer dinner and a later dinner than Americans around 9 o'clock. Here's what I would suggest. I'm going to tell you what I do to get on an airplane, and I'll be getting on an airplane tomorrow. First and foremost, I'll be taking a lot of vitamin C in the morning. I'll be taking antioxidants like zinc as well, coenzyme Q10. And then when I get to the airport, all of my possessions, my wallet, cash, whatever, will be in a one of those plastic, not plastic, one of those bags, those freezer bags, a gallon size, because I don't want it going into that extremely contaminated and extremely dangerous tray that they ask you to put everything in. So anything that's of value will be in a plastic, clear plastic bag that they can see. That is important. I will wear gloves. When I get through the line and I get to my gate, I will take off those gloves, throw them away, and put on another pair of gloves. When I go on the plane, I will take a small 3-ounce bottle of alcohol and spritz the entire seat completely, and the belt in particularly, and the arms, and just where your legs are, that little drop part on the bottom. I will let it sit for about 60 seconds, and I will vigorously rub all that, take those paper towels, and throw them away. I will wear an old clothes, because when I get to where my destination is, I'm going to put them in a laundry with a little bit of a washing machine with a little bit of bleach for the first cycle, then a second one to make it so the bleach is no longer present. I will put a mat down that my back and my pants are protected. I will then, any reading material will be in, again, a plastic bag. I will open up the plastic bag, and I'll have it. I will have a mask, high-quality mask. I didn't have the mask I have, which I've had for years because it was in my old survival kit that's not available, hasn't been for years, I will put that on, and it seals the cheeks. If I did not have that, I would get a regular mask, and I would just put some tape on the two sides of the cheeks so it adheres tightly to that. I will be using a little air purifier around my neck, and I will spray colloidal silver, one spray in my mouth, one in my nose, one in the inside, and one on the outside of the mask. That kills everything that touches it, and therefore I can have a safe flight no matter what anyone else in there is doing, because I protected where the virus gets in, principally through the mouth and the nose. And so my hands are protected, I'm not picking up, but I'm aware that I might have touched something so that it's on my clothes. So I'm conscious of that. I get off the plane, I throw off those the gloves, and then I'll get into a car, and I take off my mask, and I will have a can of aerotherapy, and I'll spray the car, and then wait about 3 minutes, then get in, because any bacteria and viruses, not even corona, just any bacteria and viruses, will substantially be reduced. I'll spray it in the air conditioning vents, so that bacteria in there, just normal bacteria and molds, are killed. And then I'll hydrate completely. I also will massage my hands and my body before I get on, my face and hair included, with coconut oil, because coconut oil has antiviral properties and it's very good for you. It doesn't bring any tension. If anybody looks, it might look like your hair's got that wet look, but it's healthy and you're protecting it. I can take my shower later, but at least I know that nothing I'm going to be exposed to is going to be a problem in my case. And then I'm going to take some coconut oil, maybe a teaspoon, when I get on the plane and I'm in my seat, and I'm going to gargle it for about 60 seconds. That's helpful for your gums and teeth, and swallow it slowly. I will follow that an hour later with 1/2 teaspoon of Manuka honey that I would brought on, a little pouch by itself in the plastic bag, because Manuka honey is great in the throat. because a lot of the spores of viruses and bacteria reside in the throat, and when it's dry, that's not good. So I'll continue to sip water throughout the flight that I've purchased inside there, and I would take it into the restroom. I'll wash off the bottle, then I'll alcohol it down so it's sterile. So I'm drinking my own water, and I'm sipping it about every half hour. I'm taking a little water to keep my throat with proper mucus and wet, because also you can wash bacteria and virus down into the stomach, where hydrochloric acid is a very good way of neutralizing most of that. And also, I will have a backup kit that I will take with me of colloidal silver, wild oregano oil, and some other nutrients, so that if I need something like charcoal capsules, I have it. Paldiarco, echinacea, astragalus, I have it. So that's what I would do, that I will be doing, and therefore I'm able to fly safely, and a lot of airplanes are empty anyhow, and they're being super cautious now by trying to sterilize the planes as best they can, but at least what they've done plus what I've done gives me confidence I'm having a safe flight. And then once I get to the place where on campus where we're doing, at this beautiful place where we're doing our 60-day retreat, outside in the sun, best thing in the world for you, plus everything has been sterilized, and there's the best air filters that I could find anywhere. And these are not for sale. You can't buy them. But even as a gift from a friend who's a scientist, it's still, I wanted to reimburse him for what he paid. It was like, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. But this way, when people go into a dining room, into a kitchen, into a meditation room, into the staff rooms, into the library, into the lecture hall, into the theater, all those are going to have state-of-the-art, I mean the best of the best, air filtration. Seven systems of air filtration, including ultraviolet. So they're in a safe environment. And people are going to be wearing, you know, some protecting devices, and we have thousands of pair of gloves. So quite frankly, I don't know of a safer place in America to be than where I'm going to be for the next 60 days. It's safe, beautiful, healthy. All the food's been purchased, plus we're growing food. And we're not allowing any strangers on. And so if there's one place to be safe and where it's beautiful and de-stressed, it's where we're going to be. Now, Ellen, nice to have you with us today. Ellen, there is an article that came out on Thursday, I believe, where the Federal Reserve is laying out $1.5 trillion to the banking community, yet people don't understand how this is supposed to help everybody else in the world, small businesses and citizens. When I look at it, I see it helps the banking community. And earlier I read your report saying how we've learned something from the banking crisis, the Great Recession. I believe that not only did we not learn anything, we're in a worse position as far as the amount of debt and amount of toxic substances like derivatives and credit default swaps and naked shorts, all the other financial instruments that do nothing to put people to work, nothing to create a sustainable future. It's pure unmitigated casino capitalism and greed, and the Federal Reserve is the kingmaker of that. Take us now on that journey, please.
Okay. So you're right. Last Thursday, the Federal Reserve said that, well, the stock market had been crashing before that, and so the Fed came out with a statement that they were adding $1.5 trillion in credit to the repo market. So the repo market is like a pawn shop where it's where banks now go to borrow. They used to borrow in the Fed funds market, but after 2008, they were afraid to lend to each other because they didn't trust each other. So the Fed funds market is unsecured. It's where banks lend to each other unsecured. So the repo market is theoretically secured. It's like a pawn shop. You put up your security, whatever it is, usually a treasury, you know, a short-term government debt treasury. So you put that up overnight. So it's called a sale and repurchase. That's what repo stands for. But it's really a secured loan. So because the deal is you're going to buy it back the next day. So you sell it one day, and then you buy it back the next day. And then, of course, there's a little interest on the loan. And then banks roll that over and over and over, so they actually make a long-term loan out of it. So the idea was to create more liquidity for the banks so they could lend more. But in fact, what it didn't do anything for the stock market, as you point out. I mean, obviously it did nothing for the real economy, but it also crashed the stock market. It went down 8% after the Fed made this announcement. And the problem, apparently, that the banks themselves did not use this new facility. It was just an offer of $1.5 trillion. Like, we'll go as high as $1.5 trillion in loans. And they were making them up to three-month loans in the repo market. And the reason that the banks didn't borrow, first of all, they don't need liquidity. What they need is they don't have the collateral, which are the bonds, the treasuries that you put up for the loan. And there's a shortage of that, and that is the fault of the Fed because they bought up all that collateral when they did quantitative easing. So now there's a shortage of treasuries. I mean, the whole system is totally, you can see it's just all credit upon credit. It's all fluff, and we should redesign the whole system. But given that this is what the system that we currently have, the banks were not biting because they didn't have the treasuries. So the only place you can get more treasuries is from the government. Only the treasury can issue treasuries, which is government debt. But of course, we're already $23 trillion in debt. I mean, the government itself, not counting all the private debt. So that freaks everybody out to go further in debt. However, what did actually have a positive effect on the stock market was the next day on Friday, President Trump said that we were going to make $50 billion available, assuming Congress approved, for the states to use for this emergency, whatever they needed for emergency purposes. So that is what we need, is we need money pumped into the real economy by the government, because they've got the money. And I mean, the way our system is set up right now, you have to go into debt. But ideally, I would say what they should do is either what they do in China or what they do in Japan. In Japan, 50% of the government debt is now on the books of the central bank. I mean, they have actually bought up 50% of the government's debt, and they're not selling it back into the market. They're holding it. So effectively, it's free money for the government. And you might think that that would be inflationary, but it's not. In fact, they can't even get their inflation rate up to 2%. And in China, what they do is, they've got the central bank and the large banks in the system are owned by the government. So what they do, we now know the Bank of England has acknowledged that what banks lend is not their deposits. What they do is create deposits when they make a loan. So they essentially just create credit on their books. And when the banks are publicly owned, as in China, the government can just borrow from their own banks, which create the money on their books, and then do all sorts of infrastructure or whatever it is they need. Then the proceeds from the infrastructure, let's say it was a high-speed train, the proceeds from the train that you charge the customers then pay back the loan. So they create the credit first, build whatever it is they need, and the proceeds pay it back. And if they don't get paid back, the Chinese don't worry about it. They just carry that on their books. It's called non-performing loans, and everybody freaks out and says that the Chinese banks are about to go bankrupt because they've got all these non-performing loans. But they're not going to go bankrupt unless the government puts them into bankruptcy, because the government is the regulator, and they don't put them into bankruptcy. They let the banks be insolvent, and they let the businesses be insolvent, because they figure it's better for the economy to keep things running, and it doesn't really matter if there's some extra numbers up there on the books. What it means is that you've created some loans that didn't get paid back. So there's some money out there that didn't get paid back. But again, it has not created inflation in China, as you would expect. In the last 20 years, they have increased their money supply by 1,800%. That's a factor of 18. And they still, through that whole 20-year period, they averaged about 2% inflation, which is what we're aiming for, 2%. So it hasn't been inflationary. And the reason is that supply has gone up with demand. They've used that money for real things, for building things, whereas we pump money into our financialized economy, which all it does is pump up asset prices, but it's not actually building anything. It's not producing new goods and services. So it inflates the price of housing. You know, the housing is already there, and you're just competing for the same house and driving the price up. Or for stocks, it drives the price of stocks up, but it is not actually creating things in the real economy. So we need to redirect our credit, and we could do that by copying what they do in China and Japan and other countries, Korea, et cetera, by making our system a public utility that's actually designed to serve the public and use it to create all those things that we need. And we, too, could, you know, be building stuff that actually serve the people. Right now, what they need is you've got all these people out of work. It's in times of crisis when the government, the president, and Congress have emergency powers. So they can do things that they haven't done before. But the only things you see them actually doing are things that are more in the direction of more control, you know, that limiting what we can do as opposed to actually serving the people. But what they could do is, for example, Tulsi Gabbard has a bill on now for a universal basic income for $1,000 a month for every American for the period of the crisis, at least. I mean, I think we should have a universal basic income all the time because we do have a problem of, you know, outsourcing of labor and the fact that AI is taking over the labor market. So we need to put more money into the pockets of the people if we want to have a consumer economy. And again, that is not going to drive up prices because, first of all, the consumers are collectively, 80% of the population is in debt, and they're actually, even with the money that they borrow, they still don't have enough money to pay off their debts. So if you did a UBI, a universal basic income, call it a national dividend, which is a much nicer term, say everybody got a national dividend, just like rich people now get dividends from their stocks, which they don't work for. It just comes to them naturally, and that doesn't make them lazy. Like everybody says, well, if you give them a UBI, they'll be lazy. No. What it does is give you a little freedom to actually do something significant, something important with your life, instead of just spending the time working for the man and, you know, doing the laundry in the evening, and all you have the energy left for is to turn on the TV and crack open a beer or something. Anyway, so if you gave everybody $1,000 a month, most of those people wouldn't be rushing out and buying new trinkets that they didn't need. These people are desperate. They need some savings. 40% of the population can't come up with $500, I think it was, in an emergency. So those people will take that money and save it, or they will pay down their debt. They will pay off their credit card debt instead of carrying those 21% interest that they're carrying now. So when they pay down debt, what they actually do is eliminate money. Money is created as a loan. It's extinguished when the loan is paid off. So that money will just disappear. It'll just go off the books, but it'll free people up. Instead of having to focus on paying off their student debt or whatever their other debts are, they can focus on actually maybe refurnishing the house or all those things that ordinary people used to be able to do. They used to have the money to do. So we can get the economy going again. If you've got demand, we've got the workers, we can do the supply part. And that's how you get the economy to go. You've first got to get some money into the pockets of the people, or they're not going to spend, and therefore you're not going to have an economy. We have mostly a consumer economy right now. But anyway, continuing on with the Fed, so on Sunday, the Fed then dropped interest rates to nearly zero for the banks. Of course, you didn't see your credit card interest rate drop. It was just for the banks. And again, this is all to bail out the banks, as you say. It's not helping the real economy, but they did that. They eliminated the reserve requirement, so banks don't have to hold any reserves anymore. They can basically lend till the cows get home and back their loans with repo loans that they get from the Fed at very cheaply, 1% or whatever. And they reduced the amount that they the interest that they pay on excess reserves, it used to be around 2%. It was pretty high. And now they've reduced it to 0.1%, which means that the banks don't have much incentive to store their money at the Fed, and so they're supposed to theoretically get out there and lend it. But they're going to have to bring down interest rates if they expect people to borrow more than they're borrowing now. People are already all borrowed up. They're going to have to reduce the credit card rates or the payday lender loan rates or whatever. Anyway, they're not. What we need to do is pump money into the real economy, and what we can do, and now is the time to do it when they have all these emergency powers, is to eliminate the Fed as an independent organization and make it a public utility that is there to serve the people and there to serve the economy. So Congress can work with the central bank in order to fund things. They just did that. Well, they haven't done it, but I guess in England, Mark Carney, who is the outgoing head of the central bank, just met with Parliament and said that they were going to work with Parliament to help solve this coronavirus problem. So that means that they'll provide the funding for whatever is needed.
Okay.
I just might mention, adding into what you've suggested, that I'm looking at a country that is being forced to use credit cards. The most vulnerable financially are food insecure. 16 million children do not have food when they need it. People cannot afford things, and yet they're still having to go into debt to buy it. And I don't see any of the legislators, with the exception of a handful led by Tulsi Gabbard, who is saying, let's stop this. We should forgive student debt. We should have universal health care. And Richard Gale and I have written an article how we could afford it and actually save money. We should close down the Federal Reserve. We should allow the Treasury only by constitutional mandate, which it has, to print money and distribute it at no interest. We should stop paying the banks interest on money that they never had. It was created by a keystroke that they're, quote, storing and then make an interest payment on, giving them interest on that. It's insane. It's a completely fixed and corrupt system. And yet they will be bailed out because all of the Republicans and Democrats, with rare exception, will have no problem, as we did with the first bailout, which some said went anywhere from $3 trillion up to $21 trillion. We'll bail them out, take all their toxic debt, and wash it clean. Even now, the money that's being appropriated, do you think any of that's going to go to the small business people? Do you think any of that's going to go to the average person? No, it's going to go to the airlines. The same airlines that won't give you a break when you have to rebook a flight and charge you the same price. I don't believe any of these places, big corporations, should be bailed out because it's socialism to them, yet they never share any of their profits, only their losses. And that we have to share only what we make with the people in our lives. It's a wrong system. Richard Gale, over to you to finish out the program. Give us a list without, don't go through all the citations, just the list of what you believe people should have.
Yeah. I'd like to, just very quickly, because we're entering into warmer weather right now, and yet because of quarantining and people social distancing, people, we're going to be spending more time indoors. So it's essential to be supplementing yourself with vitamin D. Vitamin D is very, very important. It's been shown repeatedly that the people who are not vitamin D deficient are more resilient from getting any kind of infectious disease, including these the respiratory diseases. The other ones I would be suggesting would be the elderberry, and to be certain that you, if you're going to purchase elderberry, be certain that it's Sambucus nigra, N-I-G-R-A. That there are quite a few strains of elderberry, but that's the one where there's been the most research done, and there have been studies to show that it will reduce that cytokine activity I was speaking about earlier, and there has been a little bit of work done on the coronavirus with elderberry. Echinacea, I'm not as big of a fan of echinacea as Gary is, because I don't feel sometimes some of the studies, but it is, it's been shown, especially for as a preventive before upper respiratory infection. If you have that infection and if it's gone lower into your lungs, echinacea has not been shown to be particularly helpful. Olive leaf extract is a very important molecule. This oleopoline, which is found in olives, and that has also been done. There's been research done on that to show, especially for respiratory infections due to viruses. University of Auckland, New Zealand, has done some work against the coronavirus as well with that. Oregano oil is very good especially for spraying your mouth and for getting rid of viruses and bacteria in the throat. We should remember that most of the pneumonia infections are not viral, those are bacterial. So oregano is very good against gram-positive bacteria that are associated with pneumonias. The only other botanical supplement I would suggest is, if you can find it, is called Buplerium plant. It is available online. There has been research done with this. It's a very potent anti-coronavirus activity, it shows. University College Dublin, Sichuan Agriculture University, they've been looking at this as one of their recommended herbals concerning the SARS coronavirus. And then in addition to the vitamin C, the vitamin D, the other important thing is for the antioxidants, vitamin C being one, but the other one, you could take resveratrol, but another one which is specifically associated with the lungs is N-acetylcysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E, and that's specifically related to these cytokines related to the oxidative stress that are associated with influenza, coronavirus, and many of these other respiratory viruses, echovirus, adenovirus. It's a very, very important antioxidant that could be taken. And the N-acetylcholine has been looked at by Italian study scientists and at Goethe University in Germany, specifically against the coronavirus. So those are the other ones I would mention.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, Ellen Brown. Thank you, Richard Gale. I'm Gary Nall. This has just been a continuation of discussions on the coronavirus. We still do not have a good test. We still do not have any medicines that would effectively fight this. The ones they would offer are very dangerous with serious side effects. And if they're willing to experiment on the American public with so many people suffering from chronic illness, with anti-HIV drugs and others, and if they're willing to experiment on vaccines without any double-blind placebo-controlled studies and take it right into people's lives and not look at all these other options, then I would be concerned. Have a nice day, everyone. Mother, mother, there's too many.